The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
But this system really just amounts to a lot of unequal treatment without a valid basis. The delayed removal of violating content is a second major concern, and the idea that this content is kept up on the platform during the period of maximum virality in the initial hours and days after it is posted, and that it can travel all the way across the world before this system catches up to it, and then where the content is harmful, that creates a grave concern.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, Senior Editor at Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 12th, 2022. Today, we're bringing you an episode of Arbiters of Truth, our series on the online information ecosystem. When Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen shared a trove of internal company documents with the Wall Street Journal in 2021, some of the most dramatic revelations concerned the company's use of a so-called cross-check system that, according to the journal, essentially exempted certain high-profile users from the platform's typical rules. After the journal published its report, Facebook, which has since changed its name to Meta, asked the platform's independent oversight board to weigh in on the program. And now, a year later, the board has finally released its opinion. To discuss, Lawfare senior editor Alan Rosenstein and I sat down with Suzanne Nossel, a member of the oversight board, and the CEO of Pan America. Suzanne talked us through the board's findings, its criticisms of the cross-check program, and its recommendations for Meta going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 12th. A member of Meta's oversight board discusses the board's new decision.
So let's start at the very, very beginning. Some listeners are likely already familiar with the Meta Oversight Board, and we've covered it a fair amount at Lawfare. But for others, I think the idea of an independent oversight board that's been stood up to monitor the content moderation decisions of a private social media company, that whole idea might seem surprising or novel. So can you explain just what the Meta Oversight Board is and what your role on it is in particular?
Sure. So the board was created nearly 2 years ago with the idea that sensitive determinations about content moderation should not be ideally in the hands of government, but should also not be solely in the hands of Silicon Valley executives. I think part of it was that, honestly, Facebook and their leadership wanted out of kind of holding the bag on some of these very sensitive determinations and being accountable for line drawing in an arena where there are no clear rules. It's terra incognita. You have to decide, what the parameters, what should be permissible on the platform. And they were coming under a lot of fire for doing that. And so the idea was floated to create a body comprised of human rights lawyers, journalists, experts of various kinds, and with global representation that would take on the role of reviewing some of the most sensitive content determinations and drawing on human rights law, international human rights law, as a source to determine how those content decisions should be made. And so the board was constituted. We now have 23 members. It's globally representative. It's people from a wide variety of backgrounds, law professors, former editors, activists, judges, who come together and we, for the most part, hear cases, individual determinations about a piece of content that either was removed from Meta's platforms or that remained up on Meta's platforms despite being contested. And we render decisions about whether those determinations were correct. And in some cases, we uphold what Meta has done. In some cases, we reverse. We also take on policy questions at Meta's request. And that was the genesis of this cross-check policy advisory opinion.
So before we go more into the cross-check opinion, which I think is really rich and there's a lot to talk about, I want to ask a bit of a Meta question, no pun intended, which is, why are you talking to us? And what I mean by that is that, you know, the Oversight Board presents itself as kind of a court-like judicial style body, but judges don't typically come on podcasts to discuss their rulings after the fact. And if they did so, people like me and like Alan would probably criticize them sharply for doing so. So I'm just curious how you understand your role in talking to us right now.
Yeah, sure. Look, I don't think we see ourselves as a quasi-judicial body. Some of what we do is similar to an adjudication. We're trying to apply a set of rules to review a decision and articulate why that decision has been rendered correctly or not. But we also have a kind of public accountability role. You know, for me, I'm the CEO of PEN America, and in deciding to join the Oversight Board, I felt that the company was insufficiently accountable to users, that it was lacking in transparency, and that the board had an opportunity to kind of pull back the curtain and make the workings of these labyrinthine systems of content moderation more accessible, more understandable, that we could also engage with stakeholders. We do things like we invite public comments, we do stakeholder workshops. And so we really see part of our role as to help explicate these issues for a public audience. And so a podcast is part of that.
So let's get into that explicating role. So can you just, you know, before we get into the opinion itself, can you just provide an overview of what the Facebook cross-check system is? And maybe in particular, maybe we can use as an example the case of Neymar, the Brazilian soccer star. Which I think shows both how the system is supposed to work and maybe some of its pitfalls, intended or otherwise.
Yeah, sure. So they describe the system as one that is intended to prevent mistakes, mistaken removals of content that is flagged as violating Meta policy, but that upon further review may be found not to have constituted such a violation. And so the cross-check program sort of aims to address this by providing additional layers of human review to certain posts that are initially flagged as breaking the rules. And so they call it kind of a secondary review system. There's another level of review that happens by virtue of cross-check. And when cross-check is implicated, such as in the Neymar case, the Brazilian soccer star who seems to be at the height of his athletic powers right now, but he posted a piece of non-consensual nudity on the platform. And that is one of the most kind of high severity forms of content that's impermissible on Meta, where there's a recognition that the posting of such content can cause kind of immediate and irreparable harm. And the platform sort of touts itself as being highly sensitive to that, having really strong systems in place to prevent that. But Neymar posted this content and it remained on the platform, I think, for almost 24 hours. It was seen many tens of millions of times all over the world before it was finally taken down. And that's an illustration of how the cross-check system works, which is that when content that is posted by someone who is on the cross-check list is flagged for violating a policy, it's not taken down immediately, which is what would happen if content by an ordinary user were similarly flagged. But rather, it's kind of funneled into this system with several additional layers of review. And not until it's gone through all of those layers of review isn't removed typically. And so that's what you saw happen in the Neymar case. And it's a powerful illustration of what can go wrong when this mechanism of cross-check allows content to remain on the platform for longer than it ordinarily would.
So a lot of times issues come before the board because they're raised by users through a sort of submissions process. In this case, as you say, it's an advisory opinion, and there's a bit of a dramatic backstory to how you all came to look at this issue of the cross-check system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. You know, the existence of cross-check had not attracted a lot of attention, and it did come up, though, in the board's review of Facebook's decision to kick Donald Trump off of the platform. In the course of rendering that decision, Meta did not mention that cross-check existed, but in a question that the board asked, Meta came back and referenced that they had a system of this nature, and the board asked some questions about the system. The answers were rather cursory. It came off as a system that was used in a very limited way. And then in September of 2021, the Wall Street Journal revealed the Frances Haugen sort of disclosures about Facebook. She's the famous Facebook whistleblower. And they reported that cross-check exempted Meta's most powerful users from normal content moderation processes. And Haugen specifically said that the company had lied repeatedly to the board in the course of the Trump decision about the operations and the scope of cross-check. And of course, you know, for us, that was deeply upsetting. You know, we operate in a good faith context. We really cannot carry out our work if Meta is not forthright with us, if they try to mislead us. And so to have that out there, you know, triggered for us a sense of alarm about kind of what are we doing here if the company, you know, is not owning up and answering our questions forthrightly. And so we held a meeting with Meta and expressed those concerns. We also expressed them publicly. And after that, the company turned to us and asked us to complete this policy advisory opinion.
So I think that this issue of Meta misleading you leads to some kind of interesting questions about the role of the board and the way I was getting to earlier, because you were just saying that, you know, you don't understand yourselves as a judicial body. So that may be your response to this, but I do want to pull out that comparison a little more. You know, Alan and I spent a lot of time writing about courts. If the Justice Department misled a federal court, a judge could respond by sanctioning the attorney in question, ruling against the government substantively, you know, that there's a kind of an independent authority as a separate branch of government to push back. In a situation like this one, where you kind of find out that Meta has been misleading you, does the board have any comparable power, or is it always going to be operating at sort of a comparative disadvantage with the company itself?
Well, it really can't be compared to a court, you know, in the American sense, where the authority of the court is enshrined in the Constitution and derives from the Constitution. Our authority derives from Meta. You know, let's face it, they created the board. It kind of operates at their pleasure. We have some protections for our independence, the independence of our budget, you know, some ability to control the selection of new board members when members of the board step down. And then, you know, quite separate administrations where our deliberations are protected. So there are safeguards in place, but we also operate. We could not carry out our work without the cooperation of Meta. They provide us with the cases when we have questions. You know, we turn to them. We have to get the facts that we need. And so it's an unusual arrangement. It's sui generis. You know, I would say in a case like that, you know, one of our recourses is to speak out publicly. You know, Meta created this board and has invested in it for a reason. And if the board turns around and says that the company is crippling our ability to function, you know, I think that's harmful. And so I think that is one constraint in terms of how they deal with us.
I think that interacts interestingly with the role of the journal here. I mean, you were saying, of course, you come into this in your role at Penn. You're sort of thinking of this, of the board as a transparency measure as well. I don't know of other board decisions, maybe I'm just not thinking of them, that sort of relied quite so heavily on press reporting about Meta's internal operations. But it strikes me that there's kind of an interesting synergy here with the Haugen documents, the journals reporting on them, and then you all kind of picking up that thread and pulling. So I'm curious sort of how you see the board's role in that broader kind of civil society journalistic ecosystem of pushing for transparency on the part of social media companies like Meta.
I think where the press raises a concern about some aspect of the company's operation, which absolutely happened in the case of the Haugen disclosures, the recourse on the part of Meta may be to turn to the board. I mean, that's what they did. You know, they kind of had egg on their face for having been accused of misleading the board and operating a system that was unaccountable, non-transparent, gave privileges to certain users. And then they turned to the board and said, okay, you know, we recognize these critiques. You know, what should we do with the system? How do we fix it? And, you know, as a board, we took that opportunity seriously, and we regarded it as an important aspect of the company's operation, something that was disturbing for many users to recognize it was this two-tiered system that was outside of public view that no one knew about or understood. And we were given the opportunity to look under the hood, not entirely, but to a far greater degree than other journalists or civil society organizations had been able to access. And so we felt, you know, we have to seize that opportunity. While our powers are limited, we have some powers that go beyond what anyone else really has, and we have to take advantage of them, you know, doing so on our own behalf, but also on behalf of the base of users of these platforms who have rights that should not be abrogated.
So let's get into the decision. And before we get into the details, can you give us a high-level overview of what the board found with respect to the cross-check system and also what recommendations the board made to Meta?
You know, essentially, I would say we found this system was highly problematic in manifold ways, that it raised serious concerns for us as a matter of international human rights law and as a matter of Meta's own stated community guidelines, the principles by which the company purports to operate, which include voice and dignity and safety. And so that, you know, there really were four key elements to our critique. The first is the unequal treatment of users, that essentially what CrossCheck does is grant certain users far greater protection for their expression than others enjoy. And you know, that goes back to the way that Neymar's post stayed up on the platform far longer than it otherwise would have. There are also policies that are applicable for those who are on the cross-check list that are not available to ordinary users, things like the newsworthiness exception. And particularly given the lack of transparent criteria for inclusion in the cross-check list, that for us is a real concern. We think it may be justifiable to have separate kinds of rules. That's something that one can debate. We can see some rationale for that, even from a human rights perspective, if it's users whose content may be of particular value, that there would be an extra layer of protection to make sure it's not taken down unnecessarily or mistakenly. But this system really just amounts to a lot of unequal treatment without a valid basis. The delayed removal of violating content was a second major concern, and the idea that this content is kept up on the platform during the period of maximum virality in the initial hours and days after it is posted, and that it can travel, you know, all the way across the world before this system catches up to it, and then where the content is harmful, that creates a grave concern. We also called out the company's failure to track core metrics about whether the system is achieving the end goals that it states as the rationale for it. It doesn't seem to measure those questions. The Meta would not provide us with the kind of information that we really needed to determine whether the system is effective in doing what it's supposed to. And then finally, just an utter lack of transparency about how CrossCheck works, who's in the system, you know, what privileges they get, how one might become part of the system. If you had a justification as to why your content warranted higher protection, there's no mechanism to bring that forward. And so it's a pretty comprehensive critique. And we lay out a whole series of recommendations about how we think that a mistake prevention system aimed to address the problem of what they call false positives, content that is mistakenly taken down from the platform, how that might work in a way that's consistent with Facebook's stated values and with international human rights law. And it would be a system that's drastically different from the operation of CrossCheck today.
So there's a lot of follow-ups that I know Quint and I have. And I guess I'll start by asking, so in your response and also in the opinion, a lot of time is spent on this issue of unequal treatment of users. But there's also, and I was hoping you could explain more, seems to be a part of CrossCheck that's about the unequal treatment of types of content. And I was hoping you could sort of explain why that's part of CrossCheck and whether the board found that as concerning as the part that is about treating different users differently.
Well, there's two streams within CrossCheck. The first is what's known as an entity-based system. And so basically the operation of that system depends on who the user is, who actually puts up the post. And certain users, no matter what they post, are eligible and kind of funneled through that system. There's a second system that Meta adopted actually subsequent to the public revelations of the operation of CrossCheck that is called general secondary review. And that's not entity-based. That kind of, at least in theory, is of universal application. And it's based not on who does the post, but on the nature of the post. And it's sort of purportedly flags types of content where false positives are likely and commonplace and affords them an extra measure of review to try to tamp down sort of the rate and the level of false positives. And so I'd say most of our attention focused on the entity-based system. That really seems like the piece of this that's most fundamental to Meta's motivations for maintaining such a system, to the business considerations that have driven the existence of CrossCheck. It's a more developed system. But we also do flag a series of concerns with the general secondary review, so the other kind of content-based piece.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers.
that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
I was wondering if you could talk more about the unequal treatment aspect of the critique, because one of the things that I think was really important about your analysis is that it's not just, you know, unequal treatment in terms of, say, pick a given country, you know, like within Brazil, Neymar has access to this cross-check system and a random Brazilian Facebook or Instagram user does not. There's also a concern about unequal treatment across the globe in terms of where cross-check's resources are centered geographically and what that means in terms of nationality, language, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Look, we had a lot of discussion about whether and to what degree a multi-tiered system could be justified. You know, is this something more like an airline that has different classes of service? And if you're a top customer, you know, you're given a better meal and hand towels and the like. And, you know, that's perfectly acceptable. Or is this more like the highways where everyone has to obey the same rules of the road and anybody can be pulled over and ticketed? And so when Meta first answered our questions about the system, they focused on kind of the noble users like journalists and civic leaders, you know, who would be afforded this access to extra layers of review for their content to protect against unwarranted removals, you know, in order to safeguard their voice and ensure that their content wasn't unnecessarily silenced or suppressed. But when we got into the guts of the system, we found, you know, it really wasn't structured to privilege the content that was of particular value from a human rights perspective, but rather all of Meta's business partners were eligible for the system based on how much revenue they spent with the company. All political leaders all over the globe are automatically put into the system. And that one of the main motivations for the system was to protect against what the company calls escalation risk. So the risk of, honestly, a user, a high-profile user, getting upset that their content was removed and bringing their complaint right to the highest levels of the company and taking up the time of senior officials to have to dig into it and potentially apologize and cause reputational risk to the company. And there was a major element of why this whole system was developed was to protect against that. And Katie Harbath, who's a former Meta employee, sort of told a story about how the system originated, that President Obama, I think when he was first running for office, his account was taken down. And it was because somebody had put the word dick on a list of terms that couldn't be said on Facebook. And he had a posting where he said Moby Dick was one of his favorite books. And that automatically triggered the takedown of his account. And so they sort of realized, look, we need a system that's going to protect against that. And I think that is understandable, but the system that they designed, you know, went far, far beyond that sort of scenario and just has, you know, swept up an enormous amount of content for, you know, what amounts to a level of impunity. And it can create kind of a moral hazard, because if you know that your content's not going to be taken down or is going to be taken down more slowly, you know, you could do some very damaging things taking advantage of that leeway. And then just to get to your second point about inequities in the system, you know, absolutely. The United States, North America is heavily overrepresented in the list of people eligible for secondary review. In terms of the expertise of the teams that do the review, they don't always have the language skills. They rely for languages that are not as widespread on automated tools to figure out what is a slur, for example. And we raised a serious concern that, as applied, the system kind of reinforces power disparities and disadvantages those who already kind of operate on the platform, you know, from a basis of lacking some of the benefits that other users enjoy.
Let me build off this point about disparities across regions to kind of maybe talk about something more broad than that. I mean, I do think it is well understood that, although, you know, Facebook maybe is thought of as an American platform, especially because that's where it started. It's not, just, you know, in terms of the where the billion users are. And at the same time, I think it's well known that Facebook and Meta have underinvested in, for example, as you put it, these language skills in other countries. But might this be an interesting example of Facebook underinvesting more generally? You know, you note, or I should say the opinion notes, that a lot of the reason that cross-checked content actually stays up as long as it does is because the company, and here I'm quoting from the report at paragraph 23, has not invested the resources needed. And so, you know, is this whole issue really just a story about insufficient human moderation? And if so, is it the board's position that really this is where Facebook needs to go? Or do we all kind of understand that human moderation will never be sufficient just given the magnitude, and that, you know, there will inevitably have to be some level of automation with the degree of error that always inevitably brings?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, to be honest. I think they have underinvested in the system, and we saw that through the fact that they report a persistent backlog in the content that goes through this channel. They're not able to keep up with the volume. And so there's a default, you know, in the case of the entity-based system, the default is that content remains up unless and until one of these levels of adjudication calls for it to be taken down. In the case of general secondary review, the content-based system, after a three-day time period, it times out of that queue and it's taken down by default. And there is persistently a lot of content that never, you know, really makes it through the system due to a lack of human moderation resources. So that is a problem. But I think on the other hand, realistically, with the volume at stake on platforms as massive as Facebook and Instagram, there probably never will be sufficient human moderation to meet the demand. And so I think it's a question of a balance of pointing out some areas where they really need to invest further, but also trying to come up with parameters and solutions that can work for a system of this size where the scale of the moderation challenge is never going to be fully met.
Let me also ask you a question about, I think, what I thought was one of the more interesting parts of the opinion, or one of the most interesting parts of an opinion that is interesting throughout, which is the tension that the board recognizes between Meta's role as a platform, as a public commons of sorts, and also as a business. Because the board does recognize and says quite explicitly that business interests should be a legitimate consideration for Meta to take into account. But at the same time, Meta also has these human rights considerations. And at some point, there's a great sentence about that Meta should potentially just be honest about what it's doing. And if it's going to do business interests first, it should just say that. So this is paragraph 89, and I'll just read it because I think it's a great understated sentence. But I think if you read between the lines, you can tell some annoyance behind it, perhaps. While the board understands that Meta is a business and should be able to design policies that meet business concerns, these same policies should not be characterized as serving human rights risk mitigation measures if they do not meet that objective. And so, you know, is part of the answer for Meta just to be more transparent and to say, look, we're a business and we're not going to pretend that what we're doing is designed for much other than to not annoy our most profitable content creators and not make headaches for our, you know, CEO, which, you know, might not be the answer we want to hear, but might be the most honest answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us as a board, we really value the forthrightness from the company, you know, when it feels like they're telling us it like it is. And even if that's not pretty or doesn't cast things in the most favorable light, it allows us to understand, you know, what we're dealing with. And so sort of to hear that this system was about protecting the rights of and the ability of journalists to report from conflict zones or for community leaders to raise awareness of hate or violence. Yeah, you know, that's a small piece of it. But when we dug into the guts of it, you know, that really wasn't the motivation here. And so I think what you're hearing in the opinion is sort of a call for greater honesty and a more direct dialogue with the board kind of from the beginning so that we don't have to parse through quite as much to really understand how these systems work.
So, I mean, to some extent, every major technology company faces this problem of the entanglement of business with human rights concerns. I mean, to point to another technology platform that has been in the news recently, Twitter has been really struggling with this in terms of its efforts to sort of establish itself in the Indian market, given that the Indian government under the BJP has been really pushing that platform to take things down. We'll see what happens with that under Elon Musk's leadership. So on that, in that sense, Meta is sort of certainly not alone here. On the other hand, I think it's also true that, you know, Meta is often, it feels like to me, singled out in tech reporting as having a particularly close relationship between its kind of internal policy and external politicking or lobbying arms. And you certainly see that in what the Wall Street Journal revealed in its reporting on the Haugen documents. I don't know if you can speak to this, since, of course, you're only on the Meta Oversight Board, not the Every Technology Platform Oversight Board. But I am curious for your perspective there.
I think it's a really important area to probe. I mean, we're learning something from these Twitter revelations about the interplay between political campaigns and that platform. You know, a company like Meta deals intensively with governments all over the world. You know, on the one hand, they have to operate at the permission with the permission of governments in the jurisdictions where they are active. If they don't follow the law, they will be shut down or kicked out. And we understand that. But there also is a level of interplay between these companies and governments that I think is not very visible and not that well understood. It's something that we have an interest in as an oversight board that we want to be able to look at more closely. I think on the broader question of balancing sort of business and human rights considerations, you know, we turn to, for example, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights as one benchmark. And we say in the cross-check opinion, we talk in our recommendations about content that should be given an extra level of protection against mistakes. That's sort of content that has extra value from a human rights perspective. We talk about content that can be afforded such extra protection, and that's where we do afford leeway for Facebook's identity as a private company, the fact that they have business interests, that their partners, their advertisers, the sources of their revenue are going to enjoy certain privileges on the platform. And I don't think, you know, we can declare that that's out of bounds or impermissible, but then we also designate subcategories of users that really shouldn't be given this extra level of protection, particularly those that have a track record of abusing it. And so I think if you think about it systematically in that way, it's possible to conceive of a system that both upholds human rights obligations, but also meets the company's business interests.
I want to dig in a little bit to this human rights question. And I have two questions in particular for you. The first is kind of a basic question of why are we using, or why is the board using international human rights as the relevant framework here, given that Meta is a private company and international law is generally, not exclusively, but generally understood to apply to states. And the second question is, you know, without necessarily getting into a whole discussion of the contours of international human rights law, which are vast, what are the core features that the board wants Meta to focus on the most, and that, I guess, in this case, are most threatened by how Meta has been operating CrossCheck?
Sure. You know, in terms of why it is that the company and the board turn to international human rights law as a benchmark, you know, there has been a recognition over time that companies are subject to certain human rights requirements. This is articulated in these UN guiding principles that are a very frequently referenced benchmark for us in our work. And so there is a predicate for applying aspects of human rights law and norms to the private sector. And when it came to the oversight board, I would say, look, there needed to be some source of authority outside of Meta's own prerogatives and stated principles that we would could turn to in order to adjudicate these cases. And there are a number of scholars, people like former Special Rapporteur on Free Expression, David Kay, who argued that international human rights law could be usefully applied for this purpose. And one of the great advantages of it, of course, is that it's international, it's universal. And so rather than trying to apply First Amendment jurisprudence, for example, to this global platform, you know, there's at least some legitimacy in the idea that these are universal precepts. When it comes to how we apply international human rights law to evaluate the decisions of a company like Meta, I'd say that there's a three-part test that is the most frequently invoked aspect of international human rights law. It's sort of the legality, legitimacy, and necessity slash proportionality analysis. And we apply it when we're looking at the ways in which the company constrains free expression. And so the legality prong is about whether the rules it's using to constrain expression are clearly and accessibly communicated. And so we called out the opacity of CrossCheck under that criteria. And we said, look, this is not a legal system in the sense of being put forward publicly so people can understand what the rules are and aren't. Then we analyzed it under the legitimate aim prong of that three-part analysis to determine whether the restrictions that they have in place are kind of narrowly tailored to the objectives that are permissible under international law. There are certain bases upon which free expression rights can be curtailed, including respecting the rights of others, protecting against national security, public order, and public health. And we found that absent any mechanisms for measuring how cross-check was work, it was really impossible to determine that the aims were legitimate and that there's a lot of reason to judge that, in fact, kind of business imperatives were what are dictating these particular constraints on expression. And then there's a question of necessity and proportionality and whether particular restrictions on expression are the least intrusive ways to meet the legitimate aim in question. And here again, we raised real doubts about whether cross-check can possibly pass that test, given the lack of clear criteria about who is eligible for the system, the disparate benefits from the system, the fact that those who are more marginalized and discriminated against are really not the most prominent beneficiaries here.
So let's talk in a little more depth about the board's recommendations for Meta on this. You have some, it's pretty detailed, I have to say. You have almost 10 pages. There's a chart. You have a very detailed walkthrough of proposals for what steps Meta should take to improve on those various human rights metrics that you just laid out. I don't want to make you go line by line through the entire chart, but I am curious if you could just set out for our listeners sort of main takeaways on what you think Meta should do.
Yeah, sure. Look, I'd say what we try to set out is how a mistake prevention system could work in a way that would be consistent with Meta's own objectives and with international human rights law. And so we go through who should be eligible for such a system, who should be ineligible for such a system. We set out the idea that a system like this should operate as a kind of a bargain between these high priority users and the platform. And that if people are given greater leeway to express themselves, if they run a lesser risk of having their content taken down from the platform, that should be in return for understanding what the platform rules are and for obeying them and abiding kind of lawfully as that concept might be applied in Meta. And so the idea that those who are in the system, the entity-based system, should know that they're in it, they should know what the rules are, they should commit themselves to following those rules. If they show themselves to be incapable of adhering to those rules, they should be kicked out of the system because the risk of content of theirs being harmful and remaining on the platform during its peak period of virality is too high. So that's one important aspect we talk about. We talk about this issue of the backlog and the fact that human rights-oriented content needs to be prioritized. It shouldn't be put in competition with or put behind in the queue, that content that originates from business partners and is subject to the system in order to protect against escalation risk. We talk about the disparities in terms of moderation resource and lack of translation and expertise accessible for certain regions of the world in order to be able to really fully access the benefits of a system like this. We talk about the need for clear criteria in terms of who's eligible for the system and why, and a channel whereby those who believe that they should be included in the system have an opportunity to apply and put forward their case. So, the approach we've taken essentially is to sort of set out not exactly how cross-check should be modified, but rather how a mistake prevention system could work in ways that adhere to both Meta's principles and international human rights law.
So before we close out this conversation, I want to look forward and ask how optimistic you are and maybe other colleagues on the board are about whether or not Meta will actually be willing to, or even if it's willing to be able to reform this system along the lines that you recommend.
Yeah, look, I think we're pretty realistic as a board about kind of the art of the possible with a company as large as Meta. You know, I would say it is our hope. We feel like we have sounded an alarm here about a whole series of failings in this system. And I do hope that we see substantial overhaul. You know, maybe it's not going to look exactly the way we say it should look. Maybe not all of our recommendations are going to be implemented. But I hope there is a recognition that the current system really is falling short, even of Meta's own commitments. And I think the way that they deal with these recommendations, how seriously they take them, you know, we often hear in response to our recommendations, basically the company will say, you know, kind of, we're already doing that, and that they don't provide necessarily the proof and ability for us to verify whether that's true. It's just sort of a bald assertion. So I hope that's not what we get back here. I think this opinion is going to be an important test of the value of the board, about whether this check that we provide, even with its constraints, whether it's really meaningful. And so I think the next 90 days during which Meta has an opportunity to analyze and respond to the opinion is pretty crucial and could end up being quite fateful in terms of the direction of what I've always viewed as an experiment, you know, in the form of this board.
Well, that's quite a cliffhanger to end things on. We'll keep an eye on how things shake out over the next 90 days. Suzanne, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, a Lawfare podcast series on the online information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed and in our separate Arbiters of Truth podcast feed. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.